Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by contributors from community radio stations across Canada. This episode of Groundwire was produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabeg-Akin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nahiowak and the Nakota. I'm your host, Michael Welch. On today's show,
we have $400,000 to spend on parties for millionaire hockey teams. Why do we not have basic money for people in desperate need?
We will not allow pipelines in our territory.
Contrary to other movements, this movement is led by women.
But first, here are our headlines. Our first headline comes from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabeg-Akin, the homeland of the Métis Nation, the historical territory of the Nahiowak and the Nakota. In a news conference held in Winnipeg at the Hotel Fort Garry on Friday, April 12th, environmentalists expressed their opposition to Canadian Senate committee hearings on Bill C-69. Bill C-69, they argued, was intended to revamp previous legislation, which environmentalists claim eroded environmental protections for the benefit of industry. Environmental organizations argue that the improved bill was passed in the House of Commons almost a year ago after 2 years of public consultations, and that the Senate Environment Committee hearings is a concession to lobbying from industry players who want to kill the legislation. The organizers held the news conference alongside special hearings which invited representatives of environmental groups who were denied access to the formal Senate committee hearings. These presenters, including Taylor Anyi, a lawyer representing the Saskatchewan Environmental Society, indicated the process was structured in a way that favored industry over environmental concerns.
They only allow 5 minutes for your presentation, so it's not that long anyway. And the fact that they had so many voices from industry, and I think out of maybe 10 of those individuals, two of them were people who supported Bill C-69.
According to committee chair Senator Rosa Galvez, hearings have wrapped up in Western Canada and will resume in Ontario after a short break. Thanks to CKUW's Susan Hubert for contributing to that headline. Catherine Fisher of CJLY on Sinaist Traditional Territory in BC brings us the following headline.
Vancouver's Downtown Eastside Women's Centre has released a new report called Red Women Rising, Indigenous Women Survivors in Vancouver's Downtown Eastside. The 220-page report, authored by Carol Marie Martin of the Nisga'a'gitnau and Harsha Walia, will be presented to the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls. Red Women Rising is based on unedited and unfiltered interviews with 113 Indigenous women and 15 non-Indigenous women. It offers 200 recommendations based on three core principles. It includes calls for implementation of the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples at all levels of government, Indigenous women's leadership in the design and delivery of programs directed to them, the elimination of structural violence against women and girls, legislative reforms to reduce the vulnerability of Indigenous women created by existing laws and practices, the provision of immediate services urgently needed in the Downtown East Side, and access to safe, affordable, and culturally appropriate public services. On April 4th, many gathered at the Downtown East Side Women's Center for a special blanketing ceremony acknowledging the contributions of many women to the report. This report can be accessed at the Downtown East Side Women's Center's website.
Our next headline comes to us from Will Anderson at CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on the unceded traditional territory of the Kanien Kahaka.
The outcry over the McGill political science course Poly 339 culminated last week with a sit-in of the James Administration Building, staged by the McGill students in solidarity for Palestinian human rights. The James Building had been protested in the weeks leading up to the sit-in. The course is set to be taught in occupied East Jerusalem in Israel, and as such, many students barred from the country are unable to take the class. Many students have also criticized the class for being held in Israel in the first place due to the history of human rights abuses and occupation in the region. CKUT was at the sit-in.
So we're here doing this sit-in today because we're outraged with McGill University Administration's decision to go through with funding the course for Poly 339, which is to take place in occupied East Jerusalem. This course discriminates against all students who are Palestinian or of Palestinian origin, as well as students of 15 other nationalities who are banned from Israel. Israel, in its laws, discriminates against people based on their political beliefs, whether or not they're a Canadian citizen or not. So we just believe that it's completely wrong for McGill to be not only initiating, but going against the wishes of the students by going through this course.
Despite months of controversy and outrage, the class is proceeding as planned. Will Anderson for Groundwire.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this. Listening to Groundwire Community Radio News, available online at www.groundwirenews.ca. You just heard Hall Boy by Living Hour from the 2019 album Softer Faces. Now it's time for our feature stories. As spring arrives in the city of Winnipeg, so do the whiteout parties. The annual tradition begun last year features hockey fans donning the white jerseys emblematic of their home team, the Winnipeg Jets, and gathering outside the downtown arena each time the Jets play a home game during the Stanley Cup playoffs. Winnipeg's a hockey town, and the parties are very popular. In 2018, an estimated 120,500 people showed up to that season's whiteout events. The week of April 15th saw fans once again taking the streets by the thousands.
I came from up north from St. Justa Point, and I won this package, so I'm here to enjoy the Jets to, the big whiteout party, so that's why I'm here.
The parties have not been without controversy, however. One Winnipeg group advocating for people of color suggested that the parties of hardcore sports fans converging on the downtown could be upsetting and feel unsafe for some city dwellers, and that the sight of multitudes dressed all in white could potentially be triggering for racialized individuals. Others cite the tremendous financial and social costs. The streets around the Bell MTS Center Arena have to be blocked off, traffic diverted, security, police, loudspeakers, and a video screen broadcasting the live game all need to be in place, taking up significant human and other resources. The price tag for the 2018 party stood at roughly $2.2 million, shared among Jets owner True North Sports and Entertainment, the City of Winnipeg, and Economic Development Winnipeg, with the city alone shelling out nearly $1 million for the festivities. In 2019, the province indicated it was prepared to pony up $100,000 for the parties during each playoff round. If the Jets made it to the finals, that would come to $400,000 from the province alone. Yet barely a week after that announcement, the province also indicated that it was cutting back on employment and income assistance by as much as $25 for each single welfare recipient.
I have to wonder if we have $400,000 to spend on parties for millionaire hockey teams, why do we not have basic money for people in desperate need to help them prepare for the workforce?
Josh Brandon is a researcher and community animator with the Social Planning Council of Winnipeg. He also oversaw in 2018 a street census assessing the status and needs of homeless and street-involved people in the city of Winnipeg.
The whiteout parties in particular, but the presence of the Jets downtown adds an element, brings thousands of people from other communities and into the downtown area where people experiencing homelessness spend a lot of their time. And with the whiteout parties, we're blocking off streets that they may be accessing generally without without regard for who's using those spaces on a regular basis. And so that's concerning for people. It fits in with a securitization of downtown that we're seeing more generally. For example, the search barricades that have gone up at the Millennium Library, again, excluding low-income people. So there's more and more places downtown that low-income people are not feeling welcome. And as well, I can't help but notice the juxtaposition when we have people across the city complaining about downtown being unsafe, that there's a perception that there's too much alcohol downtown. And at the same time, we're subsidizing wealthier Winnipeggers to come from suburban communities, come downtown, enjoy downtown. And to be frank, there's a fair bit of alcohol consumption, particularly at the whiteout parties. You know, I mean, they're serving their Budweiser there, and people sometimes have a few too many. And that can create conflict as well when we have large concentrations of people consuming alcohol. That can create conflict as well.
The prospect of intoxicated Jets fans interacting with downtown residents might also be cause for concern. James Favel is director of the Bear Clan Patrol, which started conducting patrols in the vicinity of the whiteout parties.
We're here to make sure that the community is protected from the tourists, right?
Stephen, a team leader of one of the Bear Clan Patrol contingents, comments on the unique nature of the whiteout parties.
For difference, I guess, between the whiteout and regular patrol is we're not finding a whole bunch of sharps out here, but we are finding the same amount of hungry people. You know, these people are out here all the same time, hungry, and somebody's got to feed them. Having the whiteout downtown, I think it's a good idea for businesses to kind of flare up and make business.
Yeah.
But it really makes a mess for the people that got to clean it up afterwards, right? So,
yeah.
In a way, it's kind of win-win, win-lose. It varies.
On Saturday, April 20th, the Jets were eliminated from the playoffs, thereby bringing an end to the whiteout parties for 2019. Nevertheless, in spite of some of the questions surrounding this franchise, hockey fans seem dedicated to their team and prepared to cope with the societal and other costs associated with their colonization of the downtown. Thanks again to CKUW's Susan Hubert for supplying some of the audio for that report. Our next feature focuses on the threats posed by the liquid natural gas industry and the fracking methods used as a part of it. An April 1st discussion at the University of Victoria showcased those threats. Attending that talk was Chris Cook of Guerrilla Radio at radio station CFUV 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UVic on the traditional territory of the Coast Salish peoples. Here is his report.
Voices from the Sacrifice Zone, fracking in BC's north, a speaking tour across British Columbia organized by those directly affected by the so-called LNG industry, toured the province in early April. Dr. Warren Bell, panel moderator and founder of the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, or CAPE.
A colleague of mine, Dr. Larry Barzilai, and I went up to northeastern and northwestern BC to visit some of the people living in what they call the Sacrifice Zone, the areas where fracking is destroying natural values, peace of mind, and good health in northeastern BC, and of course in northwestern BC, where massive mega projects are being put in place to take that fracked gas and turn it into LNG to go overseas. While we were there, we met people from all walks of life and found out some of the horrors that they were having to deal with on a daily basis. The first speaker is Karen Levin. She's an environmental consultant.
Hi, thank you for the introduction, and I'm honored to be here. I'm an environmental scientist, and I've worked in the mining industry directly for 15 years. And as an environmental consultant for the past 8 years. You see this map right here? This is where we live. And all the red dots on the map are constructed wells since 2005. And we're approximately 28,000 have been constructed to date. And looking ahead with the LNG, we're looking at over the next 20 to 30 years, approximately 100,000 more new wells. Last June, we received notification that they would be, Encana was proposing construction of a multi-well pad less than a kilometer from our house. The air quality impacts, you have toxic chemicals, diesel exhaust, the particulate matter, which is carcinogenic. You have silica from the sand, nitrogen oxide, and methane, which contribute to climate change. When we got our notification that they'd be fracking, they're probably fracking right now underneath my house. I have two small children. I'm just down the road from Ulrika. We got together, we wrote a 10-page technical report. Being my background, she wrote one based on medicine. And then we were requesting just a year's worth of environmental baseline data, which I thought was not too much to ask, just to ensure that our health, the health and well-being of our families was being protected. They didn't complete any environmental baseline studies, and 8 months later, they were given the permit by the Oil and Gas Commission to start their project. The lack of government regulations and industry practices are nothing short of negligent. It shows a total lack of respect for wildlife and wildlife habitat. I'm sure everyone, I'm thinking that everyone here has heard of the caribou recovery plan that's come into action in northern British Columbia. This is because they're on the verge of extinction, and this is hardly surprising given what we're witnessing right in our backyard.
Molly Wickham has been a central figure in the efforts to block the large LNG pipeline that is to go to Kitimat for a $40 billion LNG Canada project.
Denise 8, Sapphire 8, Sky 8, Sai Slado, Sydney, Kitimben Hesley, Wet'suwet'en Istin. The Wet'suwet'en have been resisting pipelines for the last decade. So why are we resisting all of these major LNG projects? Obviously, the environmental and health impacts we've heard and are devastating to communities. Those we know. We've done our research. We know what fracking is. We know the impacts that fracking has. And we've come to the conclusion over and over again in our feast hall, in our governance hall, that no, the hereditary chiefs of the Wet'suwet'en Nation, all of the five clans, have stood up in our feast hall, in our governance, and not allow pipelines in our territory. Whether they're gas pipelines, whether they're oil pipelines, we will not allow it. And the reason we won't allow it is because of this quote from the late Maklafle, one of our Denise, one of our hereditary chiefs. He was the oldest plaintiff in history in the Delmuka Stayway court case. And he said, "We are the land, and the land is us." It's this belief and this saying is both ancient wisdom and common sense. And that's the truth. That's awesome.
That was audio from Voices from the Sacrifice Zone, Fracking in BC's North, an April 1st event at the University of Victoria, as recorded by Chris Cook of CFUV 101.9 FM. For more background, check out the site for the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment at cape.ca. Women in the Quebec labor movement are helping to change the way we think about work and bring workers' rights to those who have previously gone without. Will Anderson at CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on the unceded traditional territory of the Kanien-Kahaka brings us this report.
Women are at the forefront of innovation in the Quebec labor movement. They're organizing workers who have been traditionally left out of unions. In the case of two recent guests of CKUT's Labor News, this means interns and sex workers. These are classes of work that typically have little to none of the rights that most workers can take for granted. Laurence Robichaud is an independent activist and PhD student. She's working to get all student interns into Quebec paid for their efforts.
This movement was born mostly in reaction to previous student movements, like the movement in 2012. But it means to go in a larger way, in a broader way, because abolishing tuition fees is just not enough to ensure that education is accessible to everyone. So this movement wants students' work to be recognized and to be paid. And the most visible part of this work is the internships. And contrary to other movements, this movement is led by women because it's feminist issue, and it's independent from student unions, even though student unions take part in this movement. It's more of a coalition of various groups who work in the same goal.
Unpaid internships are officially illegal in Quebec, but there are exemptions that can keep interns from being paid for their work. For example, interns who are working on behalf of a university curriculum or as direct training for a profession or in the service of a nonprofit or recreational organization are not required by law to be paid. Robichaud also recognized the link between the male-dominated workforce and the lack of recognition for interns.
We sure hear the argument a lot that internships are for learning and that's why we're not getting paid. But then clearly we have a lot of colleagues in other sectors who are paid for the internships. And when we look at that division, it's clear that it's a gender division and the internships that are paid are the ones linked to productive work, whether the unpaid internships are linked to reproductive work, which is traditionally associated with women's work, women labor. And it's student work and student internships is just an example of invisibilized work, but there's also other people who face the same struggles as domestic workers, caregivers, sex workers. And it's all part of a larger issue of reproductive labor not being paid. Reproductive labor has always been considered something that you should do out of vocation and out of passion, and you shouldn't ask for anything in exchange. And that's what we're fighting against.
Sex workers in Quebec are also making strides towards collective action and expanding their rights in the eyes of the law. Sandra Wesley is the director of Stella Lamy de Mamy, an organization dedicated to the well-being of sex workers in the Montreal area.
The sex work movement is fundamentally a labor movement from the beginning. It's often not perceived as such publicly, but sex workers started organizing collectively the way we see it now in the 70s, mostly fighting specifically for working conditions, trying to form unions, trying to get basic labor protections like every other industry at the height of other industries also organizing.
Wesley and other sex work activists believe that it needs to be recognized as just another line of work amongst many in order for sex workers to receive the legal protections and social benefits they deserve.
For a lot of people in our society, sex work is not recognized as work. It's seen either as violence against women, it's seen as an expression of patriarchy. There's all kinds of moralistic views of the work that we're doing, and it's a very different standard as opposed to other forms of employment that might also be very problematic, that might involve people's bodies, that might involve also a sense of being work that some people do in the absence of other better options, but we're not usually included in these fights for labor protections.
You can listen to full-length interviews with both Laurence Robichaud and Sandra Wesley at CKUT.ca in the Labor Radio Archives. Will Anderson for Groundwire.
You're listening to Groundwire Community News, broadcasting from coast to coast to coast and available online at www.groundwirenews.ca. Now it's time for our community radio report. Resonating Reconciliation is a project of the National Community Radio Association that utilized community radio as a vehicle for reconciling all Canadians with the legacy of the Indian residential schools. The initiative, starting in 2013, involved supplying 40 community radio stations across Canada with funding to provide radio-related skills for Indigenous volunteers who would then go on to produce half-hour documentaries telling survival stories and examining the agencies at work assisting with reconciliation. Gunarji O'Sullivan of Co-op Radio 100.5 FM CFRO led this project. This spring, she is taking Resonating Reconciliation to the next level with a special event involving three Vancouver-area radio stations. Gunarji discussed this effort on the April 16th edition of her weekly radio program.
The Now Society and the Red Jump Sam Society have decided to put together a big event. It's called 8 East Resonates with CITR. On May 3rd, Resonating Reconciliation listening session party. at 8 East Pender. It's free. We'll have a little bit of snacks. We'll have a little bit of a chat. You know, we'll debrief. We'll listen online to three radio stations, CITR, who has graciously provided this live stream, radio live stream for us at 101.9 FM. You can listen to Resonating Reconciliation Docs and also CJSF 98.1. They've both committed to holding a full 7 to 11 listening party, so you can listen on either station. There's www.citr.ca if you're not into the radio scene. Or you can listen to www.cjsf.ca. There will be a presentation of residential school survivor documentaries, as I said, produced by CITR, Co-op Radio, and CJSF, with Miss Christy Lee Charles giving a presentation before we listen to her radio doc. We'll find out from her what her process was, how she felt during the process, what she learned, what she found, what work she feels that we need to do.
Christy Lee Charles is a Musqueam hip-hop artist commissioned by CITR 101.9 FM to produce that station's documentary, which will air at the listener party. Here's a clip of what she said in the documentary, Why Can't the Past Be the Past?, about the history of Indian residential schools not often taught in schools.
Like alcoholism within our communities, like I see that as a residential school effect. Because of people, when they came out of residential school, they didn't know how to cope. Like they came back to their communities and they had all this culture and love and they're like so confused and there's that disconnect. And it's like, how do you deal with it? And all this stuff that happened in residential school is absolutely horrible. So from eyewitness, people have drowned their sorrows, right? Drown their memories of residential school, and that's where the substance abuse and alcoholism came from.
If you think about it, what we're doing is we're building relationships with CJSF, CITR, Co-op Radio, and then we're also adding some musicians in there who are playing cello and piano and reflecting on what they're hearing through music. We can record that, and they can play it for others, and when they do, they will say, I did this during a listening party, and it just ripples on, it resonates, you know, from one community to another.
The Resonating Reconciliation Listener Session Party airs from 7 until 11 p.m. Pacific Time on Friday, May 3rd. If your local community radio station is not airing the simulcast at that time, you can stream the event from CITR's website at citr.ca. That was our community radio report. Up next, a short musical break. Just heard Nothing Could Be Better by Home Shake from the 2019 album Helium. That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Gakin, the homeland of the Métis Nation, the historical territory of the Nahiowak and the Nakota. Headlines this week were contributed by Michael Welch, Catherine Fisher, and Will Anderson. Many thanks as well to Susan Hubert and Gunarji O'Sullivan for their contributions. Music this week was from Living Hour and Homeshake. For CKUW 95.9 FM, this has been Michael Welch. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwirenews.ca. Thanks for tuning in.